just a few words to introduce a very impressive Esra El Shafei, who is the founder and executive director of MideastYouth.com. I'll let her talk mostly about it, but I love that she said it. Part of its goal is to promote a fierce but respectful dialogue among the sort of varied and diverse youth of the Middle East. She's also led a number of online human rights campaigns that we follow here at the Berkman Center, including FreeKorean.org, the Muslim Network for Baha'i Rights, the Alliance for Kurdish Rights, and one I hadn't heard of, but it sounds interesting, No Honor, which is obviously against honor killings. And last year, as many of you know, she won the one of the Berkman 10 Awards for outstanding contributions to the Internet's impact on society over the last decade. She also won the Templeton Freedom Award for Best New Intellectual Entrepreneur. And interestingly, she's been on a number of international media, including recently on CNN International regarding the conflict in Gaza, doing podcasts and blogs. So we'll just do a few remarks from Esra, and then we should be able to have a good discussion, I think. So let me turn over the mic.
Okay, so I'm Esra, I come from Bahrain. It's a very long trip to here, so you should sympathize if I don't make sense sometimes. So that was an introduction. And I'm going to start by saying why I started this, because a lot of people kind of don't understand why such a site is needed in the Middle East. So as you know, the internet makes a very big difference when you consider the fact that we don't have a lot of freedom of speech and stuff like that in countries in the Middle East. And when you compare things like the traditional media, you can't really look at it as an example of self-expression. It's just a one-way communication, there's no interaction whatsoever. A lot of what happens there doesn't represent what a lot of us are thinking. So what was happening is that a handful of powerful elite or people with access, you know, to journalists and stuff like that, were the ones speaking on our behalf. So when we had the internet, pretty much everyone was starting to use it in order to express themselves. And it was very interesting. I think the blogosphere boom kind of took place during 2005. That's when all kinds of young people were becoming aware of this kind of technology, how they can use it, and how simple it is to get involved. So they were encouraging their friends, their families, you know, everyone to use it. But what was happening, I thought, was that it was just making, in a way, it was representing our real-life problems. So we weren't really interacting with one another because every person would have a separate blog of his own. So let's say an Israeli person, they would use the internet to talk about Israeli politics, and then just the Israelis would read it, right? Or the Palestinians who would talk about, you know, Palestine and Gaza and all that, but they would only be speaking to a specific audience, and that's Arabs and other Palestinians. So I thought we really had to take this another step further. Now that people have access, we need to kind of group them together to make sure that they're talking to each other and with each other and not just with themselves. So we wanted to go from a monologue to sort of like an interactive monologue, which just happens in the comments, to an actual dialogue, and that's what MideastYouth aims to do. So it's a first, we were doing it between Arabs and Iranians only, because Arabs and Iranians, there's a lot of racism between them, which is kind of underestimated. Not a lot of people talk about it in the media, but there's a lot of tension between Arabs and Iranians, which is funny because I am an Arab, but my parents are actually, you know, from Iran, but they kicked their butts there, so we had to move. So it's a result of the kind of persecution that you had so many Iranians coming there and then having children, and then the children would be Arab. And then Iran, of course, would claim countries like wine as their own for historical reasons. So since the 70s, Iran has always had major influence in Bahrain. They've been funding militant groups and stuff like that. They fund at least 24 organizations in the country. So we're scared because we don't want to be part of them. and in any case, it created a big shift between Iranian youth and Arab youth, and we weren't talking to each other primarily because of the language barriers, linguistic barriers, because of course they speak Farsi and we don't. Vice versa, Arabic. So when I first found MideastYouth, I thought it would just be outside only with Iranians and Arabs. But then Israelis became more actively involved in the discussion, and we thought, okay, we're going to involve them as well. And then the Kurds came, and they're like, well, what about us? And we said, okay, we're going to involve you as well. So it was kind of like a fish market where pretty much everyone was represented. And then we got into an issue of the minorities, and it was actually through my work at MideastYouth that I became more and more involved in minority rights in the region. Because before that, I was involved, but not too much, because I really didn't know, the effect that the persecution had. I thought, well, minorities, even from the name, you know, they're just a small number of people. You know, we got bigger things to deal with. But then I realized that we really had a responsibility because very few people were speaking on their behalf. And I felt that we had a responsibility, and I thought MideastYouth was the perfect platform to take on this challenge of speaking for minority rights, which is a really big challenge, actually, because when people think of the Middle East, they think Arabs and Muslims. They don't really take into consideration the vast amount, like how many people would associate the Middle East with the Yazidi Kurds, you know, and Kurds are a lot. They're like 32 million or so around the Middle East. Or how many people would take into consideration like Iranian Baha'is, you know, or, Arab Jews, and Arab Jews actually make up a lot of the Israeli population itself, and their rights are kind of ignored by the Arabs and then also by the Israelis, because in the eyes of Israel, they're Arabs, and in the eyes of Arabs, they're Israelis, so they've always been left alone fighting their own struggles. So with MideastYouth, what happened was that after we saw such a fierce discussion taking place, and by fierce, you know, I'm actually impressed that there are not a lot of name calling that takes place here, because when I first started it, there was a lot of that. But then we had to put on the rules, and we said, no, you know, we're not going to be trash-talking each other. So after we started kind of targeting the people who are ready to be involved in the dialogue, we started targeting people who need to be but are not. These are the average citizens, usually. So with Mideast Youth, we started having Arabs and Kurds interact with one another, and, you know, Kurds were asking Arabs, like, how come you guys never stood up for our rights when, you know, Saddam Hussein was gassing us? Or they were talking about things like, how come you don't distinguish our culture from yours, you know, because we always look at Kurds and people look at them as Arab Kurds, and so they would associate them with Arabs and not realize that Kurds have a completely different history, culture, language, and I think that needs to be recognized. I'm totally biased. I'm so pro-Kurd. It's not even funny, so a lot of people find that controversial, you know, because what happened at Mideast Youth is that when we have, like, our anywhere that people can register, you have to pick a country to you know, just so people know your background. And we have Kurdistan as one, and that drives people nuts. You know, they're like, what the hell? That's not a country, you know? And we always try to defend it. And it's actually the main reason why we've had so much trouble getting Turkish involvement, because they're always up in our faces and saying, oh my God, you have too many Kurds here. So it's a big problem. And at the same time, there are some Iranians that don't want to get involved because we have Baha'is around, and then there are some Arabs that don't want to get involved because there are Israelis around, you know, so it's a very big challenge for us because it's not like a group blog of Arabs. It's a group blog that represents everyone, and we try our best to incorporate all kinds of opinions on here. A lot of people look at it as a political site because we have a lot of political posts on it, but it's far from it. We have all kinds of political ideologies represented, and we have a lot of posts that deal strictly with culture and society that have nothing to do with politics and stuff like that. Which makes it even more of a challenge because now, when people come to the site, we talk about extremely controversial things like the Baha'i persecution of Iran, for example. And so when we have an Iranian artist who has nothing to do with all this, who wants to get involved, she says, well, how can I associate myself here securely knowing that you guys talk about the Baha'is, which is something that you can get killed for in Iran, right? So now it's a very big issue for us trying to involve everyone and making sure that they can be secure at the same time. Because we really try our best not to limit this place, because if you limit it, then, there's millions of voices that you're going to be keeping out. So I'm going to do like a quick run through of the projects that we have been involved with. First, I'll let you know why we did projects. First, it started out with just a general blog, but then I thought we're smarter than this, you know, and we shouldn't just limit ourselves to just writing and stuff. And plus, one of my friends got into prison, Karim, and then you're reading The Good Laser Room. Yeah, she's a funny girl. My friend, when he got arrested, that was pretty much our first campaign. It was hugely successful. And we thought that because of the amount of publicity we got for this campaign, we can get the same amount of publicity for other campaigns and therefore use our success to bring more attention to other human rights violations. So the first thing we started was the Middle East Interfaith Blogging Network, which I don't care about too much, so I give it to someone else to deal with. And this is pretty much an aggregator for, you know, involving minority voices. So there are Arab Jews in here, Arab Baha'is, Iranian Baha'is, and who else? A bunch of others, Arab Christians from Iraq and other places. And this is just to show that there are just a very diverse religious, you know, presence in the Middle East. The Free Karim campaign, I'm pretty sure like everyone here might be aware of it, yeah? So I started this with a blog post. I registered the freekarim.org name 15 minutes after I actually heard the news of Karim getting arrested. And the campaign was up and running less than an hour when he was just arrested. So a lot of the success came because we were right there from the very beginning. We didn't wait. I knew immediately that I had to do something. It was after I had met him like 2 months earlier, and I knew he was getting in prison, so I was kind of strategizing beforehand. but yeah, I started with a blog post, and in the blog post, we wrote a press release, and then we started shooting videos for the Al Jazeera listening post to get, you know, as much media attention as possible, because the first thing that we had thought of is that we had to involve the traditional media before we did the blogs. So that's where our focus was. So we were calling Reuters and BBC and everyone else, and we were involving them aggressively in this campaign. And at the beginning, they didn't really care much, so we had to do a lot to get them to care. And that's where we started doing worldwide rallies. And the first rally took place in Manama, the capital of my country. 3 people showed up. But because we couldn't invite more because it's illegal to have 4 or more people. So we were like, okay, we'll just go 3 of us. And we went there, they were taking pictures of us and everything. They were actually posing. We thought they were journalists, but then apparently they were embassy staff who took it to the airport. And in the airport there, they notified the other 2 members that they can never fly into Egypt. And then they told them to send a message to me. But yeah, that rally inspired people in Washington, D.C. to get involved. So just a bunch of activists got together in Washington, and then New York heard about it, and they did one here. I should get that one big picture. I should have gotten it. We had a really successful one. We created like a big freecam.org banner and really rallied up the embassy staff. In fact, the ambassador had written to the Washington Post as a direct response to the person who coordinated the Washington D.C. rally. So it was really interesting to see the government actually reacting to actions that were created online, basically. And at the time I was doing all of this in a dorm room. I had just graduated 6 months ago. And the teachers, I think they had seen me on CNN. They were like, what the hell? Is that what you do, you know, the whole time? They're like, you don't do your own work, that's all you do. but yeah, I'm always like in class and they think I'm aggressively taking notes, but I'm actually campaigning online. I started the free Karen campaign in a lecture, during a lecture, actually. I paid for the domain through PayPal and everything, and by the time I left, everything was already set up. So, yeah, power of the internet. It can just be anywhere. So these are just a bunch of things. The other big successful project that we took part in was the Muslim Network for Baha'i Rights. It's called this is the first Muslim site that is actively, it's actually even in real life, it's the first group of Muslims that speak actively on group on a minority. And the reason why we call it a Muslim Network for Baha'i Rights is because they always say, well, Muslims never campaign for everyone except for themselves, you know, which is true. No, I'm kidding about it. But we're changing that because it's the Baha'is are a religious minority and they get persecuted mostly in Muslim majority countries. And so a lot of people were thinking, how can we, you know, how can Baha'is be safe if the Muslim, if we as a majority don't get involved and fight for their rights? So we started doing that. My God, ever since I started this site, I've been getting at least 2 death threats for this site. So now we have a separate Gmail that is just for like threats that we just go through sometimes to see. Because it's really funny sometimes the threats that they would do. They don't know how to scare people properly. And they're usually like extremist people who just don't believe that religious minorities have any place in our societies, which is very tough to deal with because there's a growing number of people who think this way. And they're getting into the minds of young people in schools and stuff like that. And there are even on the internet very visible campaigns against them. There's a lot of sites and a lot of Google groups that are fighting against the Baha'is. So it's interesting to see that the internet can be used as a tool for social change, but it can also be used as a tool for terrorism and hatred and bigotry and severe stupidity sometimes. Alliance for Kurdish Rights. This used to be the Arab Network for Kurdish Rights until they ousted me as the only Arab who was a part of that site. So we had to restructure it, and now it's led by a bunch of Kurdish students because I couldn't find Arabs who would support Kurdish human rights. Migrants here, I love this site just because it's so important. Migrant workers get abused very often in the Gulf, where I'm from, so this is the only site that speaks on their behalf, pretty much. And we do podcasts with migrant workers, we do videos. It's very important to make sure that they get heard as much as possible. So I started the site in 2006 because I was so sick and tired of the amount of racism that they would face and the amount of no attention they would get. So it took off a little bit, but not too much, because not I don't think a lot of people care. This one took off immediately. This site took off like... And I should show you the comics. We do comics for Baha'i Human Rights because it's a very effective way to communicate with people. So you can see, if you can read it, it says, this is the first one we did, and it says, this is the Iranian president, and I should first tell you the context. So there was this bombing in Shiraz of a mosque, and it happened because of an accident, apparently. But so many people were saying, oh my God, the Baha'is, that they did this. So we did this comic to kind of ridicule the mentality that people had against the Baha'is. So it's like, what are the charges against the Baha'is? And this guy's saying, the president will be here shortly. He's in a meeting. And now this is the president. And it says, Mr. President, you convinced the world that nukes, gays, and the Holocaust don't exist. This one will be easy. And then on the board, it says, option for charges against the Baha'is. And then here it says, spies for Zionists, Western powers, communists, and stuff like that. And then Shiraz explosion. And he's smiling because that's the only one left. Because everything has been factually proven wrong. And they really do try to, you know. And then this comic was really successful. It was featured in like 3 newspapers. And we have these translated in at least 3 or 4 different languages. So Egypt announced that they would be giving Baha'is their ID cards. And everyone was like, oh my God, Egypt, the land of the free. You know, not really, because because here, they just put that on paper to shut up usually the U.S. members of the U.S. State Department and stuff who were speaking, becoming more active towards the situation of the Baha'is. And of course, since who signs their checks? The president of the United States, right? So they have to be sure that, oh yeah, USA, we're democracy, you know. But yeah, and then, so this lady is pregnant and she says, what happened? I thought you were due 5 months ago. And she says, I was, but I'm still waiting to receive an ID card so that I can get a health insurance and a birth certificate. And I'm just showing you these because we're one of the few people like do these kinds of comics in the Middle East. So that's where they get a lot of successful. And it's also a nice strategy to get into the traditional media, to get your message concisely into the traditional media. Like if you write a blog post about this, yeah, people are going to read it, but it's not going to get into the right people, right? Not everyone's going to read it, and not everyone's going to get the message properly. So we started doing comics because it's also a very effective way for interacting with young Middle Easterners, who are the ones we target. So we try to get away from blogging specifically and into visuals. So we do a lot of videos and we do a lot of comics and stuff like that. And yeah, so here's a bunch. I'm not going to do it all, but this is called Prison Break, you know, like the show here. So this is after the Baha'is got arrested here, and says, okay, sir, we've arrested and jailed 6 Baha'is, what now? And he says, what now? Yes, what now? Well, now we will wait until every Baha'i is arrested. And he says, but sir, there are over 300,000 Baha'is in Iran. We don't have enough room in our prisons. And he says, then we'll release everyone in prison until we've replaced them all with Baha'is. And then he says, sir, Baha'is are infidels, but they're harmless. You'd be turning loose thieves, rapists, and murderers. And he says, in this country, there's no crime worse than believing in what we don't, which is why bloggers, women rights activists, and everyone else gets arrested all the time. This is true for Egypt as well. Like in Egypt, every once in a while, they let go all the prisoners because, you know, they think they're being nice. But really, who are they letting out? They're letting out rapists and murderers and drug dealers. But yeah, people like Karim, you know, no, threat to national security, keep him in prison, you know, because seriously. And when we contacted the embassy about it, they said, we told them, how can you let so many people out? I mean, these are rapists that have been in prison for less than a year, you know, and you're letting them released. And they would say things like, Karim is in prison because, you know, he broke the law, and then they never get into specifics. So they expect us to say, oh, okay, good, then he's in prison. Thanks for clearing that up, you know? But really, it makes no sense. Okay? And now I wanted to show you a video that we did, just because it's kind of relevant to right now I'm talking about. This video is, we took the voice of Martin Luther King and JFK and Gandhi, and we thought, what would happen if these kinds of leaders were influencing the ones in Iran? So we took like a CNN segment and we edited it out, and now it looks like the new Iran. It's called Iran's New Voice. And basically what happens is, it's very self-explanatory, so I'm just going to play it. And I think you really like it. Yeah, freaking good. Thank you.
Iran's leaders have been addressing the public with a new policy that the government is launching today.
I pledge you that we shall neither flee nor invoke the threat of force.
Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred.
They'd be offended if they knew that their words were being white, so we intend no disrespect for these. Okay, so that's just an example of what we do to spread the message. And I think it's a very effective way of showing your, you know, doing what you do, because some people, they just blog and yeah, that's okay, but with things like these, it's very important. And of course, since YouTube is blocked everywhere that is not civil, we have our own place where we put all our stuff in there. And I want to show you also one more thing. Since these were so successful, we started this thing. This was a separate group, not part of Midis Youth. They call themselves Sensio. It's apparently Latin for opinion. But what we do here is like all the... This is the production team that does all the comics and all the videos and stuff like that. And I just want to show you this as the last one. Because it's... So this is a quiz for... it's an expert level quiz to quiz your Iran knowledge. And it says, which one of these choices has not yet been labeled as a national security threat by Iranian authorities? Kurds, journalists, homosexuals, bloggers, women, Baha'is, Tom and Jerry, YouTube, academics, Barbie dolls, Flickr, and then L, flying ninja bears with jetpacks. And if your answer is L, you are correct, because that would just be ridiculous. But here's the thing. It says this list is authentic. I mean, it's not an exaggeration, because all of these things have really, at one point or another, been dismissed as a national security threat. Yes, that includes Barbie dolls. My God. But, yeah, it's kind of a way to ridicule what's happening in Iran and trying to do it in a way that is less offensive than just, you know, name-calling them. And here's where we put our videos. And we're doing competitions soon where we're giving out 2 flip phones for people who do the best videos. You know what a flip phone is? I just found out about it like 2 days ago. you know what a flip phone is? Yeah, basically. And it's very good for people like us because, you know, let's say you're in Afghanistan and you want to shoot a quick video and you want to upload it, you don't have to go through all the techie stuff. You just do it and then it comes up and you edit it and you just upload it, and it's a very small size, so you can easily, and it easily embeddable to blogs. So now it's easier than ever to get involved in this kind of stuff, so it's best to take advantage as much as possible. And for all our projects, there are different teams that do it. Like, let's say your passion, for some reason, if you're an Arab, is Chinese activists. So a bunch of them, Arab and Chinese activists, were trying to free the 4 cyber dissidents in China. And then no honor is the one that you talked about. That's because there's so much honor killing where the legal system is messed up because there are people who commit honor, who commit murder in the name of honor. Like, let's say you have a brother and you're in a village in Jordan, and you want to come from a very conservative family, and you have a relationship with someone, or you've caught, oh my God, walking with them, you know, then your brother can come and kill you, and he'll get in prison for 6 months only, which is how much you get prison for, what, like DUI here or something like that. That's something you can get away with there and just be like, horrible. And then we did this minority map, where you can, this minority map comes with like a backend here, where you can edit it and say like if it's a, you know, ethnic or religious, and then the number, like status, if they are persecuted against, protected, and by protected means by law, usually, not necessarily socially. Like Jews in Bahrain are protected by law, but sometimes there's a few idiots who just don't like, oh my God, get out of our country, but they're protected, more or less. There are minorities of concern, like the Christians in Egypt, they are protected in a way, you know, but they still get discriminated against and stuff like that, so, okay. Here it is. This requires Flash Player, but you can see it later, I guess. So, podcasts are a big thing. This is an example of a podcast that I did from Gaza. We won't listen to it, but when the war first took place in Gaza, it was a very big situation, and I thought we need to hear the voices of the people in there. We can't just read the, because it makes a difference. So when I was podcasting from there, and this is actually the podcast that appeared in CNN Live Report, they butchered the purpose of this. They said it's a pro-Palestinian, but we weren't really, you know, taking sides. We were just kind of representing the, what's happening there. And we did podcasts from inside Israel as well. So we worked at CNN with that, and we said, in your face, CNN, you know.
Did they run any kind of
No, CNN, you know. They say we don't have time, but really it's because we don't want to acknowledge that we did a mistake. So, and we did that through Twitter as well. So we're just like, Ed, you were wrong. Fix it. but yeah. So when we did this podcast, you can actually hear the bombs going off in the background, and that really kind of riled up some people because it makes a difference when you read something, you read about something, and it's okay, you know, you don't take it that seriously. But when you actually hear the panic in people's voices, then it really makes it more real. And this was the first, and I think it was the only blog where we podcasted from Gaza. And what was happening is that so many Gazans were saying, well, we can never win this new media war with Israel because we don't have the blogs and everything, you know, electricity, and not enough people would know the language either way. So we were calling them on cell phones through Skype and then recording it into the podcast, and then we launched about 3 or 4. So we were calling them, making sure they're okay, and at every opportunity we got, you know, we did a podcast with them. So they would explain where the bombs are coming from, how are the children reacting, whether or not innocent civilians were caught, whether or not there were ambulances in the region. And then they would always be, in the podcast, they would always be doing something like running or, you know, getting in the car quickly and leaving. So you can actually see the experience a lot of the time. And then someone took the podcast and turned it into video, which I just found out about now while I was in there, while I was in here, actually. And the last video I'll show is that in the Middle East, there is a very controversial thing that comes with, they talk about media ethics a lot, and Al Jazeera gets a lot of flack for it. They say why the difference is, actually, Gillian, it's in, they also talked about it in the Jon Stewart thing that, yeah. Right? Why there's so much blood and gore in Arab media, and then why isn't it in the American media? Like, even in 9/11, you will not see pieces of burned bodies and stuff like that. So they said, here it's not acceptable because it's a matter of ethics and stuff like that, but there, it's just all over the place. Even if you don't have permission from a person's family member to take video, they will take it and then they will produce it. They don't, no permission required, nothing. So it's a very controversial issue. And then people were saying all the time, which I have a problem with, and they said, it's impossible to be realistic to show the crime without showing the blood and the gore, you know? But we kind of took that and we turned it, and we wanted to send a very effective message without using any blood and anything. So what happened was that there was an animation film called Persepolis, right? Is that everyone who knows about it? And we took that film and we said, well, this is really nice, you know, we can do something better. Well, no offense to her. But we edited it into 2 minutes and we changed the sound effects entirely, like the voices and everything. And what we did was that we turned Persepolis, we edited out, it took a long while, so I hope you guys enjoy it. We edited into like a story of a young Baha'i girl, okay? And of course, the Baha'is have nothing to do with Persepolis. You know, if she saw this, she's probably gonna sue us for copyright or something. But I don't think so, because it's like, just don't get any ideas, okay? But anyways, so, but the only thing we did was the only thing we took was the animation, and we changed the voiceovers, and we had just random strangers walk in the street, and we're like, can I just record you saying this? And they thought we were completely weird, because if you hear the things that they were saying, you'll understand why people were like, what the hell are you doing, you know? So, this is my favorite video, but this is, keep in mind that this is, was used as an example to show that you can appeal to people's emotion and attract them without using blood and gore, but by using stuff like this, you know?
Oh,
listening.
I bet that riles you up, but we didn't show blood in there. Well, yeah, this one, it appeared in one other video that we did like this. It appeared in a newspaper, and BBC called us, which I always brag about this part. They call us a historic movement because we're pretty much the only Muslims who are visibly that have formed an organization to fight for the Baha'i human rights. But there are, in fact, many Muslims who feel the same way, and I think they should speak up as well. So I think that's pretty much it for me. All right? So I'm going to, you ask me questions. Yeah, okay.
So I'm just wondering, in terms of, you showed us a lot of stuff in English. Yeah. How much of it is in different languages? Yeah, and how much, and also, I mean, just sort of, it appears you have so much in English. Do a lot of folks in the Middle East, sort of, is English accessible? Is it something that, you know, is it more important that it be in Arabic or Persian or local languages? Just sort of your sort of thinking behind that.
Okay. So, first of all, when I started Midishuth, it had Arabic and Farsi in it. And then it was a very big problem because we were leaving out the Kurds. So if we did it in just Arabic, the Kurds were like, we want to be involved. But the Kurds, of course, they come from all over. So they either speak Turkish or Iranian or this or that or just Kurdish sometimes. And we thought, okay, well, I mean, we can't just have like six languages represented, you know? So we thought, well, okay, we're going to have it in Arabic. And then we thought we're being, oh, and in Farsi. And then the people were like, but I'm a Turkish Kurd, you know? I don't speak either. So then we kind of restructured it. And we said, okay, we'll do Midishuth. And it was just in English. And for 2 years, it was just in English. And every time we attempted to move on to a different language, it wouldn't work out too well, except for now. Now we have, I'll go to it right now. We have an Arabic site that has been launched and is working very well. So the day we have launched it, we had about 60 applicants who wanted to get involved. Firstly, concerning the videos, like this video, for example, we have it in Farsi as well. And the same with Persepolis, the video, in Farsi as well. And we have accompanying posts from BahaiRights.org, because BahaiRights.org also has an Arabic and a Farsi section. So everything that is relevant to our Farsi-speaking audience, we translate immediately. Everything that is, sometimes we write the articles in Farsi beforehand or in Arabic beforehand and then translate into English. And it's a lot of work, so like 24/7 work, because when you deal with this region, you always have to take the linguistic barriers into account. So this is why we need a very big, you know, group of volunteer translators who need to be there pretty much all the time. You can see like here, this is the Arabic site, and this guy like writing from Yemen, this one from Syria, this one from Bahrain, and it's been really successful. You can see a lot of posts that people are getting more and more involved, and we're creating better discussions, because it's one of the few sites, even in Arabic, that will have content from people who don't necessarily speak the language, like if Iranian blogger said something that is relevant to an Arab audience as well, you know, we would have to translate this. The comics that have appeared in newspapers in Egypt and stuff like that, they are also in Arabic, and they are in Farsi and stuff like that, and sometimes, like when we send a mailing list and we find that some people are obviously Arabic, we'll just send them the Arabic newsletter and tell them, please spread the word, and then they write about it in Arabic, and that's how we reach our Arab audience. And we're lucky enough to have very close contact with some of the best Iranian bloggers, so when they write something and then they link to it, then there's a big discussion going on. Sometimes they translate our podcasts, like they do voice dubbing and stuff like that. There's a very good Persian blogger called Arash Kamangir. Probably some people, yeah, you know him, he's really great. And he's been involved in Midishuth since the start. He's been blogging with us first, and now he does translations. And he does, like, if we want to get in touch with the Iranian audience, we just contact him and he deals with it. We're like, Arash, get this out, bye. And he just deals with it. And that's what we did with all these, the Persepolis thing was very viral. It went all over. And so many Baha'is were getting in touch and getting all mushy, because Baha'is tend to be that way. They're like, I was in tears when I saw this, and we're like, okay. But yeah, they're very friendly people. And that's kind of the message that we're sending, you know? It's just that they're not going to bite you, you know? So let them live in our countries instead of, you know, because so many of them have just moved out. And they're successful people that we need, you know? They're the ones who are going to build our societies. We don't want them to just leave and, you know, empower other countries. We need them. So we always do our best to protect everyone, to make the Middle East attractive for everyone, you know, safe for everyone to be involved. Because I know they changed my family's history, because if we hadn't moved, I'd be Iranian by now, probably at even prison, being beaten to death or something, you know. But yeah, it makes a big difference when people do things for minorities, and members of the majority, they don't take action, because there's always a lot of anger. You find this a lot with Kurdish activists, and be like, oh, these Arabs, you know, they've never fought for our rights, and you find so much anger in there. You know, my family, I've met some members of my extended family in Iran, and we are the Sunni minority there, so they persecuted us. Execution, you name it, they went through it. Well, my family did. And they're always so angry. They're like, oh, you know, they never spoke for our human rights. They never did this, never did that. And it just causes a big gap between, you know, citizens themselves. So if I have Kurdish and Baha'i people in, you know, Bahrain or anywhere else, first of all, one of my big strategies is that I don't do local politics to keep myself safe. And that's what I think more people should do. When I find really good and effective people who do so many risky things inside their own countries, sometimes I feel so bad because we need them and they put themselves at such obvious risk. And you don't do that, you know? What you can do is that you get involved, like you, for example, I'm pissed about something in Bahrain. I can easily go rant about it. I'll get a phone call. Interrogation. Come to us at office number 5. Most likely you'll never go home, you know, something like that. But what happens is that I just contact my friend. She lives in Sudan. So I'm like, deal with everything in the Gulf and then just don't come here. So I send to her and I say, oh my God, Bahrain just did this and this and you need to write about it. And so she says, you know, this is migrant workers in Bahrain, you know. But then I read the article, but then it goes under her name. So when someone contacts me about it, I'm like, I'll get in touch with her immediately. This is unacceptable. But you play with them. That's what you do because you don't want to, you know. So every time someone important, you know, comes and they try to get in touch with you and they say, what are you doing? You know, this is just dangerous. And you say, yeah, it is. I completely agree. They shouldn't be talking about local politics. And you try to do that as well because you try not to get your site blocked in the region. So you try to pretend all the time that you're, you know, not too in your face. So that's what I do. That's how I pretty much exist. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead. Okay. So I'll start with the first one, and that's how we get things to be viral. So we've had a big trouble at first getting known because I was a nobody. Well, kind of, I still am. But, you know, I was not involved in local blogosphere whatsoever because I was so incredibly bored by local blogging, you know. So many people like Hugh Strader were like, you know, Sarah's eating a sandwich, you know, things like that. I don't care, you know. So I, what I do is when I started the group blog, it was a big challenge for me to get them on board. Well, after I got them on board, they would write about it and they would put links on their own blogs that would already have been viral. So when I first started Midas Youth, my intention was always to go beyond the mainstream bloggers. But I wanted to involve them first because if you involve the mainstream bloggers, then they already have the audience that you need to make them aware that this exists. So I contact people like Arash and, you know, Mahmoud and stuff like that from all these kinds of places. And I tell them this is the site and I tried my best to sell it as best as I can. 90% of them were like, who are you? Go away. And then 10% of them were like, oh, you know, awesome idea. We're totally in. And then that's how we gained our audience at the beginning. The second way we gained an audience is that the media was starting to pay attention to us because what we're doing is very interesting and very unique. And that's how you know that your idea is going to succeed. Is because if you're doing something that already exists out there, no one's going to look at it. But we were doing something like involving Kurds and Baha'is and people were like, what the hell, you know? And so they just started reading about it because it was things that not many people would know about. And then how do we use media? We have accounts. I'll show you actually our networking page. I think that's the URL. Oh, not this. So we have accounts. Oh my God, here it is. So we have accounts on all of these places. We're just getting started with Twitter because we weren't fans at the beginning. Because it was answering the question, what are you doing? And we weren't interested. But then we thought, well, they should be asking, what are you doing as an organization? Because that's when people will start. And we have like MySpace and Facebook usually. And yeah, Facebook was, when we started our group blog on Facebook, so many people became aware of it and they started applying to be members of the site through there. But yeah, we always try to be as visible as possible in all of these kinds of places because that's where young people hang out and you try to attract them into getting involved in this kind of activism. So when they go online looking for dates, you're like, well, what about the Kurds, you know? It's true, you know, she's just making fun of that because on my Skype thing, they would always, so many people would contact you wanting to chat about, what are you wearing today, you know, stuff like that, and I always have a clear note, please do not, you know, Skype is not a dating service. Oh, how do you keep them safe? So what we do at Midas Youth brings me to another point, is that that's kind of like, that's not what makes us powerful. What makes us powerful is that we have a network of bloggers and activists that we host free of charge. So let's say a really good Iranian activist wants to get involved. But she's too dangerous to put on the site, you know, because she's already been in prison like 3 times, but now she's living safely in the Netherlands or something like that. For people like that, we try to help them spread their message by building a site for them and then hosting it and then not associating it with us. So we're trying to say, okay, we'll create a space, but away from us a little bit. And they perfectly understand this because they know, okay, it's for safety reasons. And then we write blog posts here that we link to that site, but they don't know that she's kind of a part of this, but not really, you know, so it keeps them safer. And it's a lot more expensive for us to deal with. and a lot more work. But we don't say no. So let's say you're a really good activist in Bahrain, and if something happens, you know, like I just don't want to be, I don't want to put my name next to yours because it's just too tough. So I'll just build you a separate space that you can use, and then we'll link to you from inside the site, and that people will not know that that's really. But in a way, we're making sure that our readership will be shared, you know. So we also host, like, let's say you don't want to be an author here, but you have a really great, good idea. So we do our best to, we give free technical support, we give free hosting, free domain, so anyone who wants anything, they can just grab it, basically. We host about 80 sites right now across the region. Anything from places like Iraqi Kurdistan, and we try our best to fundraise for them. So there's like this guy blogging about an orphanage in Iraq, and he was saying, well, we need funds, you know, to buy heaters for these kids. So we had built him a site where he can fundraise for all of that, and we share our readership with him. And people, and then he ended up raising like $3,000 to, you know, get heaters and stuff. But yeah, I say we're kicking ass at this. Yeah, the sexual terrorism one, and it's not, a lot of people assume it's because of the sex in the URL, but not really, because you can access other sites that have that in the URL, but it was blocked, migrant rights was blocked for a while in the UAE because we talked about them, sexual terrorism was blocked in Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Middle East was blocked in Yemen for like a couple of months, and then they just, I guess they just lifted it because it's not blocked anymore, Free Karim was blocked in Yemen as well for a couple of weeks, and then we have this Yemeni guy who is a programmer. Oh, he's actually been interviewed a lot by Global Voices, Walid Al-Saqa. Yeah, he's really good. So now we're working together to build, you know, to just kind of extend the use of proxies in the region. And he's really good at that. He's like an engineer or something. Anything I need, I'm like, Walid, get this done. No, he's really good. Yeah.
Do you have any say in the content of what people put up on your site? Do you moderate it or kind of determine what kind of content is that? So you were saying that some people had problems or conflict with others who were on the site. And so is there an expectation that people are coming forward with this idea of, you know,
yeah, so obviously it's a controversial site, so lots of controversial content. Many people disagree. I disagree with, there's some people here that I don't even like, that, you know, write down here. But because they're respectful and because they don't resort to name calling, they have a very good way of getting their point across without offending too much others, you know. Like some people think, oh my God, you support the war in Gaza, that's totally offensive. What are you doing in the site, you know? But in the same way, you have to give a way for other points of views to be represented so that everyone can understand each other. But that doesn't, there's one thing people misunderstand, is when they come to a site like this, they assume that we're trying to promote, you know, free, you know, tree-hugging people, peace everywhere. We're not that naive, I should say, you know, because you can hate someone's guts but still tolerate him, you know? So when you come to a site like this, not everyone likes everyone, but at the same time, they don't resort to saying, like, you're an idiot, get out of here. No, they do things like, with all due respect, I disagree entirely, I think your logic is flawed, stuff like that, you'll read that all the time. Sometimes, but not too much, because they're already aware of the level of discussion and the quality of posting. So they know that if a comment like that, they won't get away with it. Sometimes we contact the person directly, and we unapprove the comment, and he edits it, and then you know, we package it and send it out again. In terms of, but I never enforce any of my beliefs here personally. So, but there are things that we don't tolerate, and things like, you know, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, it exists really. So stuff like that, we don't. You know, obvious racism. And there are some kind of racist things here that people kind of get away with. Like sometimes a Turkish author would say something kind of mean to Kurds, and then the Kurds would be like, I'm never writing here again if this guy stays. You know, so we would have to write a comment and say, like, with all due respect, please, you know, we want your opinion on the site, we value it, but try not to be a jackass about it. But yeah, that's true. But we try to have everyone can represent their viewpoint. So we try our best not to say, oh, you know, you can't say this, you're an Israeli, well, you can't do this, you know. We try our best just to, like, there are, people who are extremely pro-Israel from Israel, and then there's people who are so anti-Israel. They're like, I hate this country, it's so nationalist, this is Zionism, I don't support it, you know? And then there's a lot of fights here within Israelis, which is funny because every time someone says Israel united, I'm like, come to see if I read the discussions. It's not, so yeah, fierce but respectful.
With respect to Middle East, you said, you know,
so we call it, yeah. So we call it Midas Youth, but there are people as old as 60 on this site. And so we have a banner for these old folks, you know, and we put like, if they want to promote Midas Youth, we say Midas Youth, and then in the between brackets, even though I'm not a youth anymore. But there are no age brackets. It's kind of targeted towards youth, but it doesn't limit to only young people. But the majority are young people who, like, between 18 and 30 usually. So I think that age is the most important to involve. But we have one kid, she's like 14, and we always edit her post to make sure the spelling is okay.
What's the sort of country distribution?
Country revenue distribution a lot. We get, it's Middle East youth, but then we have people who are not part of the Middle East, like from Pakistan. We get one from Afghanistan. We got a leap of obviously North Africa. So we got Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, Yemen. I think one country that we don't have anyone from is Oman. And when I went there, Emma was like, oh, can you be a part of this? He's like, I'm too lazy. So I'm always like, contact to make sure that that country's represented. But usually how it's represented is always when people when people visit there and then they write about it. You know, we try our best to cover it. But when I went there, it's like, well, now I know. Nothing's going on here. But the problem is that there's a lot going on, but just under the cover. Migrant abuse and stuff like that. And people would be like, well, yeah, there's one blogger. And I was like, would you be interested in covering migrant human rights up in Oman for me to see it? And then he would be like, but they come into this country, you know, they deserve it, basically. So we're just like, all right, we're going to stay out of the country for that for a while until we find someone reasonable. But yeah, we got almost every, we got at least 25 countries represented, which is a lot considering the size of the Middle East. Let's see, there's about 5 from Bahrain. Israel has a bunch. Israel has, let me see, I actually have some of them here on the author's page. Let's see, you can see the little flags. It's a lot more than this because I haven't updated this for a while. There's a lot from Sudan. Now we're getting more from Iraq. Egypt has a bunch. Yeah, we have a lot from Iran. Iran and now I would say Saudi Arabia would have the most. We have some Americans who have either lived in the Middle East. Like this guy is a soldier, so we thought it was relevant to add his opinion because there are a lot of American soldiers in the Middle East, so we thought, well, we'll involve him as well. This is a comic artist from New York. She does a bunch of comics for us, and it's really interesting because she also believes in comics, but she doesn't do the comics that we showed you. What she does is that we send her stories from Middle Eastern people, like they submit their stories and then she turns them into comics and targets Americans so that they become more aware of how the Middle East is. And it's really cool. We get a bunch from Israel and Palestine and Syria, so a bunch of them. See, that's what I mean. When we put Kurdistan in here, they just go nuts. They really do. We got so many males and they're like, it's not a country, you know, just call him a Kurd. And we're like, no, I'm going to keep it in there. And it's funny because a lot of members of administration also said, like people, you know, who they decide with me, they're like, well, they're right, you know, it's not a country. And I'm like, oh my God, that's so offensive. But yeah, so we have a lot of issues. So. Yeah. Thank you. World domination, for sure. Now I'm gonna build, yeah. If you give me a couple years, I'm gonna build the biggest empire you've ever seen. But it's on the list, yeah. I'm gonna go back to Iran, I'm gonna go back to my homeland, and they're gonna see what I'm kidding. Oh, that's right. I'm kidding, you know.